from official disregard and denial to mismanaged response, each day the COVID-19 crisis brings into ever-sharpening clarity the hypocrisy and moral bankruptcy of the current ruling class. Claims of American exceptionalism and greatness are revealed to be a crumbling mask for the systemic rot that pervades. We ask Dr. Gerald Horn, activist, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, and one of the most prolific radical historians writing today, to talk about how the coronavirus unmasks capitalism. Professor Horn, thank you for joining us.
As the pandemic clearly weakens an already dysfunctional capitalist system with Great Depression levels of unemployment, hunger stalking the land, and homelessness at record levels, it is well past time to analyze this global system that has been responsible for so much misery for so many centuries. It's perversely ironic that it was in the 14th century that the plague weakened Europe, setting in motion forces that eventuated in the destabilization of feudalism. And today, a similar plague is exposing the irrational contradictions of capitalism. For-profit hospitals engage in mass layoffs of workers while slashing the wages of doctors in the midst of a pandemic that shows few signs of slowing down. Hunger escalates as farmers destroy crops, and homelessness grows as hotels stand empty, leading in turn to further layoffs of hotel workers. Meanwhile, Congress borrows trillions to further line the pockets of the 1%, while adamantly refusing to reconsider the massive tax breaks given to the wealthy by the illegitimate Trump regime in December 2017. As ever, people of color, especially African Americans, suffer disproportionately, overrepresented in the ranks of the deceased and the unemployed and the homeless. Perhaps worse is the overrepresentation of this besieged minority amongst the ranks of the incarcerated. This has taken a particularly nasty turn in Louisiana, which is competing with New York City for the leadership of deaths and infections, but also houses a prison, the curiously named Angola State Prison, carrying the name of the Southwest African nation that contributed a disproportionate percentage of enslaved Africans' unpaid labor to the wealth of the United States of America. Jails and prisons like Angola are no more than petri dishes for the creation and circulation of the virus, just as social distance regulations are just one more excuse for the police to replicate so-called stop and frisk and further harass Black American young men in particular. And of course, social distancing regulations are also used as a further excuse to lock up Black and brown people, while some of these same cops politely hand out masks in communities defined as, quote, white, unquote. The recent murder of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia, is just one example amongst many of how this republic, founded on preserving slavery, continues to exact a heavy price on descendants of enslaved Africans. This is not the only defaming disfiguring of Black people delivered and made clear by this pandemic. Crisis reveals character, as is often said, and the character of this society has been revealed not only by the escalating rates of spousal abuse, yet another pandemic, which I'm afraid to say is accompanied by like escalation of elder abuse, child abuse, even pet abuse. Of course, this is a function to a degree of skyrocketing substance abuse, which is exacerbated by the fact that many healthcare packages have no mental health components. But yet another kind of defaming and disfiguring is represented by what we have heard from the White House, which tends to blame the victim once again. That is, the reason allegedly for the high mortality rates of the pandemic in our community is because of our high rates of underlying conditions, including comorbidities, hypertension, asthma, etc. Ignored is the stress of white supremacy that often induces hypertension, or the environmental racism that oftentimes induces extreme respiratory conditions. Also ignored is the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and dispossession of the indigenous and the population of Mexican origin, which explains the role of people of color as frontline workers on the subways, in the halls of the hospitals, in nursing homes, stocking grocery store shelves, even construction sites. Beyond nursing homes, hit hardest of all are those in slaughterhouses who have been devastated. Also ignored is the third-class treatment Black Americans in particular have received at hospitals, a legacy not only of slavery and Jim Crow, but also payback for our refusing to support a slaveholders' revolt in 1776 that led to the formation of the United States in the first instance. For just as settler colonialism involved class collaboration between and amongst European settlers across class lines, slavery often involves staunch opposition to the rule of slaveholders, an opposition that has led to our continuing punishment, not least by public health authorities. Thus, in the 1930s in Tuskegee, Alabama, unwound was the notorious syphilis experiment, whereby public health authorities intentionally allowed sexually transmitted diseases to spread like wildfire in a ghoulish experiment. Or consider that in 1963, in my neighborhood in Black St. Louis, the U.S. authorities experimented with radiological weapons with cavalier disregard for the health of the residents. This indifference to Black health continues to this very day and sheds light on why health outcomes for Black patients is worse than that of many others, as represented by a startling article in the New York Times of May 11, 2020. What is ironic about this horrible state of affairs is that it is not just an indictment of capitalism, but U.S. capitalism, which by design has been the global guarantor of world imperialism, a system that allows for the looting and plundering of resources and populations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America on behalf of the 1% in the North Atlantic community. The problem for world imperialism is not only that this system has become unsustainable as the Trump regime, in a desperate bid to sustain U.S. imperialist hegemony, has alienated erstwhile allies in Berlin and Brussels, but as well, the deal cut in the early 1970s by Kissinger and Nixon to co-opt China against the then Soviet Union has backfired spectacularly, as Beijing is now recovering from the pandemic more rapidly than Washington and is expected to grow at a spectacular rate of 9.2% by 2021, which will further highlight the thesis that a pandemic in the 14th century helped to usher capitalism onto the global stage, while a pandemic in the 21st century has helped to destabilize it. At some point in the near future, Kissinger's deal with China, instead of being viewed as a masterstroke, will instead be viewed as a fiasco for U.S. foreign policy amongst the lines of the allying with religious zealots in Afghanistan in the 1980s against Moscow, or the 2003 invasion of Iraq engineered by George W. Bush, or the 16th century entente between Ottoman Turkey and England, which helps to explain why we are speaking English in North America and not another language or not being here at all. Other than racism, the other complement of capitalism that helps to explain the horrible condition of so many in the United States has been anti-communism. For U.S. imperialism as the guarantor of world imperialism waged a war not only against socialism, but against the very idea of government, which socialism was thought to embody. Recall that it was U.S. President Ronald Wilson Reagan who announced that the scariest words that one could hear is that, quote, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help you," end of quote. This has meant a war on public schools by dint of the expansion of charter schools and private schools, the onslaught of toll roads, not freeways, the arrival of for-profit hospitals, not public hospitals. This is also meant that in the midst of a national emergency, workers in Florida and elsewhere are confronting an unemployment compensation system designed by dolts like then-Governor, now-Senator Rick Scott. In 2011, he designed a system that was designed not to function properly so as to discourage workers from getting their benefits. As often happens, this was done for the benefit of the capitalist class so that they would pay fewer taxes and also help to supplement a larger reserve army of labor, that is to say, the unemployed, so as to drag down the wage level of the working class as a whole. Theoretically, there are irreconcilable contradictions between workers and capitalists, just like there are irreconcilable contradictions between landlords and tenants, and slaveholders and slave masters. However, the deadly virus of class collaboration has infected the organization of workers, leading to a disease to which few are immune. By the way, to get a cinematic view of the virus of class collaboration, study carefully the Samuel L. Jackson character in the Hollywood blockbuster Django Unchained. Class collaboration has facilitated the ascension of this system of neoliberal capitalism that has reached its apex in the United States of America, meaning the government did not have shock absorbers or an adequate safety net to deal with the emergency delivered by the pandemic. But this was by design, not only benefiting the 1% in North America, but their comrades worldwide, who found investment in the United States to be safe from expropriation without compensation because of the relative weakness of the working class movement here compared to, say, Western Europe or even Japan. This has meant an absence of what we should be fighting for, a paid sick leave policy, a sustainable child care and elder care system, universal health care, that is to say, an exceedingly improved social welfare system. But I'm afraid it's not just the pandemic that has weakened the inhumane system known as capitalism. Also complicit has been environmental degradation, as evidenced by the Trump regime seeking to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, the plastics that are choking the ocean, the species on the verge of extinction, with consequences so ghoulish to contemplate that they have yet to be fully contemplated. The creeping southward of the already immense Sahara Desert, the impending melting of the polar ice caps, all of this and more speaks to the profits before planet and people attitude that has been the hallmark of U.S. capitalism and imperialism. So how did we arrive at this dangerous state of affairs? How is it that the supposed richest nation on planet Earth, with 4% of the world's population, is absorbing north of a quarter of the deaths from this pandemic while enduring more than a million infections? In sum, what are the roots of this capitalist system that, as noted, was sparked into formation not least by the pandemic of the 14th century? Now, much of what I'm about to say in the next few minutes is detailed in my book that will be published within days, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. In brief, to understand capitalism and the almost messianic belief in so-called free markets, of why in the United States, the Euro-American population in particular, tends to put greater faith in corporations than the government, as opposed to even their counterparts in the European Union, for example, one has to understand that capitalism arose during an era of religious sectarianism, eventually pitting Christians against the Jewish, then Christians against Muslims, then Catholics against Protestants. Historians now concede that the nation that gave rise to the United States of America, speaking of England, was the first racial state and expelled the Jewish population as early as 1291, almost 800 years ago, and 200 years before the Spanish did the same. But with the rise of Spain, which sponsored Columbus, at the same time that the Jewish community was expelled, London reversed course and embraced to a degree the Jewish population and combined this population with the disaffected Irish and Scottish population and sent these groups to the Americas to confront the Spanish, especially in Florida, St. Augustine in particular, founded in 1565, and rebranded these formerly dissident populations as, quote, white, unquote. Meanwhile, the Spanish insisted that their settlers should be religiously correct, that is to say, Catholic, while England moved towards a pan-European project, that is to say, whiteness, which was more successful in subduing the indigenous and enslaving the Africans, producing a cornucopia of wealth, not least because the pan-European population and project presented a broader base of humanity. A turning point in this inglorious saga arises in 1676 in colonial Virginia, when a bevy of mostly European men revolted against the colonial administration, which was perceived as not moving rapidly enough to dislodge Native Americans from their land and turn it over to these rebels. Bacon's Rebellion, as it was called, in many ways formed the template for 1776. Indeed, if you can understand Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, you can understand the concept of class collaboration between and amongst Europeans of diverse class backgrounds, and therefore you can understand the March on Wall Street a half century ago by tens of thousands of Euro-American working class and union members in support of the war in Indochina and then U.S. President Richard M. Nixon. If you understand 1676, you can understand the 2016 presidential election in the United States of America, where even a majority of women defined as, quote, white, unquote, supported a confessed sexual assaulter. And if you understand 1676, you can understand what I call the Staten Island question. Why is it that of the five New York City boroughs, the one that is most heavily comprised of the Euro-American working class is most likely to vote for the right wing, or why Eastern Kentucky, to cite another example amongst many, repeatedly turns out in sizable numbers to elect and reelect Senate Majority Leader Mitch the Grim Reaper McConnell? 1776 revolt against British rule that led to the formation of the United States was sparked by the Royal Proclamation of 1762-63, which sought to restrain settlers from moving westward, further seizing the land of the indigenous, which jeopardized the business model of real estate speculators like George Washington. And that, along with Somerset's case of 1772, which called into question London's further support for enslaving Africans, jeopardizing the fortunes of slaveholders like the murderer's row of so-called founding fathers, including Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Patrick Henry, not to mention lawyers for slaveholders like John Adams. By the way, this profound moment in history is illustrated in the movie Belle, starring Google and Mbatha Raw, and directed by the black British director Ama Asante. The resultant U.S. Constitution sought to move away from the religious wars that characterized the earliest stage of capitalism and late feudalism, particularly Protestant versus Catholic and Christian versus Jewish, by installing the First Amendment, which called for religious liberty, which was also a further step along the path of creating a synthetic whiteness or pan-European identity politics, which created the numbers to overwhelm the indigenous and enslave the Africans. Likewise, the Second Amendment allowed for armed citizens' militias for a similar purpose, an illustration of which one has just witnessed in Lansing, Michigan. What helped to restrain slavery in the United States and elsewhere was the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, which created a general crisis of the entire slave system, resulting in its collapse. This also undermined the racial axis that had supplanted religion, which in turn led to the rise of class as an axis for society, an epoch in which we are still ensconced. It is not an accident that the struggle for an eight-hour day accelerates after slavery is abolished in this country, which in turn gave rise to a socialist movement that, despite setbacks, is too still with us. Still, the United States proved to be a dream for many European settlers who, with a little luck and a lot of pluck, could seize land theretofore controlled by the indigenous, and stocked that land before 1865 with the labor of enslaved African labor. Even during the United States Civil War, 1861 to 1865, the sainted Lincoln government not only engaged in mass executions of Native Americans in Minnesota, but forced through Congress the Homestead Act, which involved a gargantuan seizure of Native American land and turning it over to European settlers, are constructing so-called land-grant universities that are still with us today that were reserved for Europeans and Euro-Americans alone, yet another example of the kind of class collaboration that helped to build this former slaveholders' republic. Even then, there were strident oppositional voices, as represented in the general strike of 1877 in St. Louis. and the growth of the farmer-driven populist movement in the 1890s. But as so often happens, the latter did not altogether understand white supremacy and was wrecked on these shoals to the point when one of its early leaders, Tom Watson of Georgia, later emerged as a bitter and virulent Negrophobe and anti-Semite, playing a leading role in the drama that was the lynching of the Jewish American Leo Frank as World War I was dawning in 1914. The socialist movement that propelled the general strike of 1877 remained intact, however, though weakened throughout the 20th century, and thus was confronted by Reagan and his anti-government psychosis that was driven by the hysteria that still reigns in Dixie as a result of the entire system based on slavery being destroyed, with slaveholders losing a massive investment in the bodies of enslaved Africans without compensation, one of the largest expropriations of private property without compensation before the Russian Revolution of 1917. The other strand of anti-government psychosis was driven by the reaction to the federal government under the pressure from the black community and its allies from below and the socialist camp and national liberation movements from above being forced, that is to say the federal government being forced in 1957 to send federal troops to Little Rock, Arkansas to enforce a judicial mandate for school desegregation. Federal troops were there to prevent black youth from being mauled or killed by angry Euro-Americans across class lines who then rioted shamelessly, fueling this anti-government psychosis. This was not just a phenomenon in Dixie, since there was a similar uprising in Boston in the 1970s when black children were being bused into Euro-American neighborhoods to attend school. This reflected a noticeable dearth of working class solidarity, not unlike Little Rock, but reflecting the root of settler colonialism, privileged class collaboration between and amongst those of European descent across class lines. Of course, New York has not been immune, as reflected in the revolt against integrated housing in Yonkers in the 1980s, as represented in the informative movie Show Me a Hero, which is still well worth watching. Little Rock 1957 and Boston 1970s and 1980s Yonkers were in many ways a revolt against the 1930s, when inspired by the Russian Revolution, Communist Party membership surged to the tens of thousands, which in turn led to mass labor organizing drives by the Congress of Industrial Organizations, leading to the formation of United Auto Workers and the United Steel Workers, amongst other mass production unions. In some ways, the organizing of these unions reflected what socialist and Marxist leadership thought of as the theory of surplus value. That is to say, the capitalist class, a parasitical class at roots, seizes the value produced by workers at the point of production, paying out in wages a minimum for workers to survive. It requires the mass organizing of unions in order for workers to claw back a larger percentage of the value that they had created, and in turn create programs that continue to allow the working class to survive, both arising in the 1930s when the radical left was at peak strength, speaking of unemployment compensation and Social Security. Many are outraged by the wages paid to professional athletes, unfairly in my opinion, but they should consider that those that employed these athletes are appropriating even more as these parasites recline in their plush luxury boxes. Of course, the capitalist class did not supinely accept this state of affairs, and to understand their counter-revolution, consider Harry Bridges, leader and founder of West Coast Longshore Workers who led the San Francisco General Strike of 1934. For decades, this militant labor leader, well-born in Melbourne, by the way, was hounded and harassed by the U.S. authorities who claimed he was a communist and sought repeatedly, though unsuccessfully, to deport him. A different fate befell a black man, Ferdinand Smith, now largely forgotten, who was one of the most powerful labor leaders of the 1930s and 1940s because of his founding of the National Maritime Union, which basically controlled imports and exports into the United States because of their labor on ships. Born in Jamaica, this black communist and close comrade of the great Paul Robeson ultimately was deported back to his homeland in the Caribbean. Yet even in the 1950s and 1960s, the model of development for capitalism in the United States was forced to shift. Global pressure meant more black voters, introducing a political element that often was a sworn antagonist of the ultra-right. The revival of European economies post-war meant the rise of the European Union, headquartered in Brussels. To that point, the United States was a version of the European Union, melding English versus Irish and German versus British and German versus French and Serb versus Croat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, into a sturdy identity politics of whiteness. Simultaneously, under pressure from the anti-Jim Crow movement, racist immigration laws were loosened in 1965, allowing for the arrival on these shores of more of Asian and Latin American descent. This ignited a mass exodus of those defined as white away from the Democratic Party, deemed responsible for these changes, into the awaiting embrace of the GOP, which remains the party of so-called white grievance politics, a case study that was exemplified in the election of November 2016. The routing of the left, especially the black left, has led directly to this unfortunate state of affairs. Slavery was officially barred in the 1860s, but today, those not part of the 1%, or perhaps more accurately, the 0.001%, are neo-slaves. Consider that on the way up with their various investments, these parasites privatized profits, seizing wealth produced by dint of the tireless labor of workers, but on the way down, when their misdeeds and misjudgments, not foreseeing a pandemic that had been discussed for decades, on the way down, they received our hard-earned tax dollars in the form of bailouts engineered by their comrades in Congress. What is this but a system of neo-slavery? So what is to be done? Over the past minutes, I've sketched a number of programs: paid sick leave, universal health care, subsidized child and elder care, subsidized food banks, and expansion of food stamps, construction of more public housing with first dibs to the currently unhoused, a spectacular rise in the minimum wage up to $25 per hour, et cetera, et cetera. But all of this is conditioned on two factors. One, massive organizing drives by unions, which presupposes deep-sixing AFL-CIO policy, which has involved penalizing those of the socialist left while aligning with the more hard policies of U.S. imperialism in Southeast Asia and Southern Africa alike, and two, a revival of the black liberation movement, which presupposes renouncing the spectacular blunder that was made when the NAACP purged suspected communists, including founder W.E.B. Du Bois in 1948. I say revive the black liberation movement, not because of the insulting term identity politics affixed to any initiative by the descendants of slaves. I say this because the descendants of enslaved Africans historically have been the force most likely to be willing to confront the ultra-right without compromise, because slavery ultimately is the most intense antagonistic relationship. This antagonistic relationship reached a kind of climax in 1776, if not 1565, when settler colonialism descended upon St. Augustine, Florida, and continuing in 2016, when this minority voted against the oath in the Oval Office by a rate of 9-1, a rate higher than any other demographic. I say this as well because the abject backwardness of a good deal of the union leadership will require an independent force to be lit beneath their feet by the black liberation movement. I say this also because some on the left have lost sight, to repeat, of the unavoidable fact that the class relationship between slaveholder and slave represents one of the most irreconcilable contradictions of all, just as settler colonialism, to repeat, involved class collaboration between and amongst Europeans across class lines, rebranded as white across class lines, which has introduced a deadly virus of conciliation into the labor movement. Right now, there are a few alternatives, for as the body bags pile up in the freezer truck or dumped in mass graves, the aphorism coined by Frederick Engels, the founder of scientific socialism, continues to resonate. One road leads towards barbarism. The other road leads towards socialism.
You've been listening to Dr. Gerald Horn, activist, professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston, and one of the most prolific radical historians writing today.